Mary Beth.
Thank you for coming, everybody. My name is Liz Judge, and I'm with the Aspen Institute. And it's my pleasure to introduce to you Thomas Stewart, editor of the Harvard Business Review. And the panel tonight is going to be talking about business for social good. And it's been a theme of the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival. So here you go, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm really glad you all came out on this rainy night. As you know, we are the warm-up act, first of all, for the band that follows us at 9 o'clock, so we have a hard stop, and if we're not having a good time, if at any point it really flags, they're going to start right away, so you guys have a choice, as to if you help it drag, you'll get us off the stage faster. On the other hand, I think we're going to have a good time tonight. The other thing is that we stand between you and Karl Rove tomorrow morning. So that's why we have, tacit knowledge sharing accelerants in front of us, so that we can work with us. I'm going to basically we're going to run this. I can't see you in the dark. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk for a little while, and then I don't know what we'll do about the lights, but I want to actually turn this as much as possible into some kind of a conversation. So we'll maybe find a way to raise the house lights as things go on. I'm going to quickly set up the topic, briefly introduce the panelists, and let each of them say a few words, and then I think we'll go to discussion as soon as possible. I can't remember when it was, a decade, maybe 15 years ago, that Peter Drucker started getting very interested in what he called the third sector of the economy. In between the public sector and the private sector, there was a sector that included churches, included non-governmental organizations, and he began to do a lot of work with this. He did work on church management, did a bunch of very interesting interviews with the managers of mega churches, a guy named Bill Hybels, who was the CEO, but he was the pastor of something called Willow Creek Church outside Chicago, began working with the Girl Scouts, and began working a lot with the not-for-profit sector in general. Jim Collins, who's been up there this week, just recently issued a monograph called Good to Great for the Social Sectors. So as people have been looking at this third sector of the economy and the third sector of business and what might call the third sector of work, we've begun to realize that it actually is a much more varied sector than you might think. It ranges from some traditional charities and churches and the traditional industries there or businesses there, to non-governmental organizations, to social entrepreneurs, and we could get into an interesting definition of what social entrepreneurship and social enterprise are, but as opposed to non-profit organizations, they are fundamentally profit-making organizations that seek to be working in areas of considerable social importance. And allied with them, a whole lot of intermediaries, pilot fish, support groups, both in government and in traditional business. You can get an argument that NGOs are taking on some of the regulatory functions of government in developing nations, for example. So there's a very interesting divergence and growth in this third sector. And we have here representatives from a whole spectrum across the third sector. On my extreme right, which is not a political statement, because he's your extreme left, and I don't think that's a political statement either, is Cameron Sinclair, who's the head of an organization called Architecture for Humanity, and on the bag he's carrying, because his slogan says, design as if you gave a damn, or as if you gave a damn, or give a damn, right?
One I think you other. Can give a damn.
You can give a damn, or if you gave it at the office, that's all right. next to him is Beth Brook, who works at Ernst & Young, you used to be able to say a big 8, then a big 7, or a big 6, then a big 5, now one of the big 4 accounting firms, with 110,000 employees, and though she's wearing black shoes, it's one of those things that you might call a white shoe firm. So she represents a sort of a traditional business looking at this social sector and the doing well by doing good or doing good by doing well business. Jonathan Greenblatt is a social entrepreneur, founder of a company called Ethos Water. He recently sold out, literally, to Starbucks. can tell you a little bit about that story. But he actually got his start campaigning for Bill Clinton in 1992 after he got out of college, and then went to, and will tell you, I think, the story of Ethos Water and what it is about. And not on your program, but an added starter, Janine Benyus, who runs something called Biomimicry, an organization that she will talk about, which is among sort of, a green arms merchant that helps companies that helps companies that would be willing to help, you know, companies from General Electric and ExxonMobil to Ethos Water in trying to discover ideas and technologies and processes and designs in nature that can help business be greener and more effective and more profitable. I think I got that more or less right. So why don't we start in the order I named you, and I'd just like to, you know, tell us a little bit about what you do, why it matters, why it's worth money, either to be given to or to your firm or whatever, and we'll carry on from there, and then, as I said, open up the conversation to you guys.
Okay, I'll kick it off. I'm Cameron Sinclair. When I was in college, I started an organization. I'm a reformed architect. I started the conference by saying that we're an industry where form follows fevered ego. And I was very despondent in the field, and what I really wanted to do is get architects and designers involved in some of the greatest issues that we're facing, many humanitarian crises, but also systemic issues. As we grew just via the internet, and we've grown to the largest design-based nonprofit in the world with over 7,000 designers in 54 countries. But that's not what was really a spark for the organization. What we realized, and maybe it's the Scotsman who doesn't like to spend money, but what we realized is rather than developing solutions to Western-imposed solutions to critical issues, we worked with communities to develop appropriate solutions that could be built by the community members. So what that means is that we're generating innovative ideas that can be, while working with community members, we can develop buildings, structures, but also sustainable development, long-term sustainable development. But in skills training within the community, we start businesses within the community. So to give you an extreme version of this, we were working in Sri Lanka after the tsunami. Now, many NGOs came to try and do some educational buildings, and they had costed out the buildings to be somewhere between $100,000 to $250,000 to do an elementary school for children. While using appropriate technology and renewable resources such as rainwater collection and solar to bring clean water to the communities, we actually trained some of the community members to build these buildings, and we paid them because the number one thing somebody wants after a disaster is not a home, it's a job. And so developing these jobs within the community so that they're a self-sustaining organization. What happened is we were able to build a school for around about $5,600. But when we left, the money that the community essentially earned,
That's 1/25th. Is that right? I'm bad with place value.
Something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
But,
okay. Yeah.
But the real amazing thing is when we left, we gave them all the plans and how to construct, and they had the skills. With the money they earned, they built another school. So, you know, what this is it's empowering local communities to be a part of the reconstruction process. And rather than having mass unemployment like you have in Iraq, which leads to people joining insurgencies due to lack of food on their kids' table, you actually have them involved in the process. And so what that means is that the bar of success in post-disaster reconstruction is not basic shelter, but sustainable prosperity. And it's done through creative and innovative sources. So we've been able to tap the design and architecture market to respond to these issues. I have some images I can show some people later, but there's so much more to hear from.
Before we leave you, that's a response to a crisis. What's your day-to-day work? I mean, can you give an example where there's not a crisis you're responding to, but sort of quotidian, day-to-day housing vernacular stuff?
Well, Mother Nature kind of kicked our ass last year, so it's been one long crisis. But we have been involved in low-income housing, especially down on the Gulf Coast. Not post-disaster, but trying to introduce disaster mitigation and to start small home businesses. But also we've been dealing with, we developed some mobile HIV/AIDS health clinics in sub-Saharan Africa, and having people involved in the reconstruction and ownership over that. And what that means is that we can transfer the baby. You know, we're not there, and we're not hand-to-mouth. There's a trade-off. So eventually you can roll these things out and begin to introduce healthcare into rural communities.
So what I'm hearing is a kind of a bottom-of-the-pyramid business model,
right,
where instead of building one-off huts, wigwams, whatever they might be, you're actually creating ability to scale, get some improvement, but you're still also working to create businesses at the bottom of the pyramid in that industry of housing and construction that is relatively
right,
untouched by other people.
To just give you one other fact, and I've said this many times. Currently, 1 in 7 people live in slum or unplanned settlements right now. In 25 years, it's going to be 1 in 3 people. So most people will go home really depressed or go and get drunk. But what I see this is an opportunity to improve living standards of people around the world and have them as active participants, so they're the ones earning money. Because if they earn money, their kids go to school. If they earn money, they get clean water. So it's really about improving living standards through economic forces.
And interestingly, if you've ever been to India, you might, you know, you see women or women walking along the road with basically big buckets of manure on their head, which they then turn into paddies, which they turn into bricks, which turn into houses or sheds, which then melt in the next monsoon.
Right.
But fundamentally, what you need to do is find a way to create something that is more permanent, that's not a trailer park, because
right,
a trailer park is the inappropriate
technology. We leave that to FEMA.
That's right. That's good. Fair. to the public sector. Beth, talk about, we can go to almost an opposite extreme. Ernst & Young's headquarters in New York is in Times Square. It is an absolutely stunning, modern glass skyscraper with really, it's one of these security things where you have to take your picture, you have to have your picture taken, and if you look like your picture, you shouldn't be allowed to out of the house. So we're really talking about a very different kind of architecture and a very different type of corporation. What are you doing on this panel?
Tom, you're so flattering. when we look at our business, we look at it really in three dimensions. We fundamentally believe that we're building the people of tomorrow. When you look at the amount of financial talent that the accounting profession actually supplies to the financial markets, it's an enormous force in the talent that we train and what we do for younger children around financial literacy. So we look at the business as building the people of tomorrow, then strengthening the companies of tomorrow, and then contributing to the communities of tomorrow in which we operate. And when we look at the business those three ways, and you reflect back on what we've talked about the last few days in around U.S. competitiveness, a few issues. Education, fundamentally a problem. Innovation, the innovative capability of America, fundamentally a problem. Around the world, poverty, fundamentally a problem. When we look at our bill and our competencies, we look at contributing to education through financial literacy and deploying the 110,000 people that you mentioned, Tom, to support children around the world in financial literacy. But also we take it to the dimension of entrepreneurship to address the issues of poverty and the issues of innovation. And we, for 20 years, have supported something you're probably familiar with called the Entrepreneur of the Year program. And that started as a concept of supporting entrepreneurs, because we do believe that the companies of tomorrow, if you look at the Global 1000, it's amazing the churn of companies in the Global 1000. Companies don't last forever. The churn is phenomenal when you look at the statistics. They come from companies that are just starting today. And we fundamentally believe and support the celebration of entrepreneurs. And so in local communities, we, for 20 years, have been going through independent judging and a contest to award an Entrepreneur of the Year award to a local company, then conducting a country program to have a national winner, and we now conduct a World Entrepreneur of the Year program to where there's a world winner in celebration of entrepreneurs. Now, we take it then down one more level, which is we have a social fellows program where we actually take some of our best people and allow them to go to the developing world to work with companies that are just barely starting in the developing world that really need some financial help and competency help. And we let some of our best people go and truly get committed to working with entrepreneurs struggling in the developing world. So in that sense, financial literacy, entrepreneurship is fundamentally what we're committed to as an organization, because we believe with 110,000 people around the world devoted to that, we really can improve society from the ground
so,
up.
So part of this is watering the seedlings of tomorrow's Dells Absolutely. And Microsofts and, you hope, big-ticket clients for Ernst & Young. I mean, just to put it to what benefits the firm.
It is enlightened self-interest.
Right. Well,
many of our clients are former entrepreneurs.
Nobody wants benighted self-interest,
yeah,
right?
It is.
One of the questions I have is what's the difference? Is there a difference in the firm? And by the way, one of the other interesting things about Ernst & Young is among the professional services firms, it may be the most progressive vis-a-vis women in the firm. I mean, mm-hmm. I know it's an extraordinary record there. But there is a sort of a line where something is pro bono and where something is the beginning of a real practice area. Mm-hmm. It's a fuzzy line, but how does that look at the senior levels of the firm? I mean, how does that work?
When you think
charity or is this investment?
It morphs. When you think about building the people of tomorrow, building the companies of tomorrow, and building the communities of tomorrow, it's sort of pro bono when you're over building the communities of tomorrow. At some point, it can morph into building the companies of tomorrow as what you're doing transitions, and sometimes it never does. It stays pro bono forever. It's one of those, you know it when you see it.
If I'm 27, come to work for Ernst & Young, can I get partner working up that part of the firm? Can I get the partner working up through the entrepreneurial program?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's an enormous area. And it actually is something very appealing to our people in that they love working with the entrepreneurs and the startups. And in fact, we're just now, just this year, in the Entrepreneur of the Year program, we've now created, in conjunction with the Schwab Foundation, a new category for social entrepreneurs. And that is really to support those companies that, on a for-profit basis, are targeting social good.
You're so good, Beth, because that's the perfect segue into our token social entrepreneur. and actually, Jonathan, your company story is itself interesting, but insofar as you can talk about that and put it in that context of social entrepreneurship and social enterprise.
Sure.
Tell us about it.
I could try to do that. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here on the panel with such accomplished individuals. I'm wondering when someone from Aspen is going to figure out that I shouldn't be here. But I also should
Well, you'll
thank,
get the hook if you don't
I'm
talk.
Sure yeah,
the band will be on its way.
But really, I want to thank everybody from Aspen and from the Atlantic who's done such a marvelous job with everything all week. So with that said, I'll tell you guys a little bit about Ethos Water. But to do that, I think I need to start with the context of the world water crisis, because that's really, at the end of the day, what Ethos Water is about. And there's been some talk about it this week, but I think it's important to go through some statistics here tonight, like the fact that there are 1.2 billion people on this planet without clean drinking water, upwards of 20% of the world population, and an estimated 2.4 billion people lack basic sanitation, right? 40% of the world's population. Water-related diseases are the leading cause of death among children around the world. I'm not talking about something complicated like avian flu. I mean diarrhea, which kills more children under the age of 5 than any other disease or condition, right? In sub-Saharan Africa, women walk on average 6 miles a day to get water for their families. And this is walk is sort of a generous way of putting it. The funny thing is this is a problem that we can solve. Many times people are surprised by this statistic. The average cost to provide someone with a lifetime supply of clean water, $25. $25 is what it costs to give someone an opportunity in the developing world to live vis-a-vis clean water. So it's a problem that we can actually solve. And at the same time, the bottled water business in this country, the stuff we've been drinking all week, is an enormous market.
I was going to say $25, not to bite the hand that is watering us or not feeding us, but 25 bottles of Fiji water is about how many of you have had 25 bottles of Fiji water this week?
25, yeah.
I mean, so you have drunk enough Fiji water to take care of somebody's lifetime of clean water. Just to
you,
put things in context.
Yeah. You ahead. And 150 million other Americans. So this is sort of the essence of Ethos Water. How do you link 150 million people here in the U.S. with the billions of people in need around the world? Mm-hmm. And that idea is where Ethos begins. My business partner, a guy named Peter Thum, who unfortunately isn't here, was on an engagement with a consulting practice in South Africa, saw how people were living in the townships, some of the poorest places in the world, and realized they didn't have clean drinking water. He had a background in beverages and thought, maybe there's a way we can link drinking water here with getting people water around the world. He contacted me and we did a little bit of research. And what we found was that consumers here in this country, and you can ask yourselves this question, most people buy bottled water on the basis of price and convenience, right? What's in front of me when I go to the store? Or what's on sale? What we saw was an opportunity to create a brand with emotional appeal, right? That our customers would actually see an opportunity by drinking this water to help children around the world get clean water. And in doing so, thereby, the consumer almost becomes converted into an activist who's changing the world through the simple act of just buying a different bottle of water. That got us both really excited. So we quit our jobs, started Ethos Water with a dual mission to help children get clean water, which we'd achieve by donating 50% of our profits. We're a for-profit business. We endeavored to be. But donate half of our profits to get clean water to kids around the world by working through different non-governmental and charitable groups operating in Africa, Asia, etc. And we would raise awareness about the world water crisis here in the U.S. And we'd need to do that because, frankly, people in America, we just don't even know there's a problem. Right? There's potable water everywhere you go in the United States. So we're not really aware that this is such a big public health problem. But it is, and it has educational and social, economic, and political impacts which touch us even here in the U.S., even here in Aspen. So that was the mission. Started the business. Couldn't find any investors, though, who would come, you know, within a mile of Ethos Water. Nobody was interested in the business started by rookie entrepreneurs that would compete with Coke and Pepsi and Nestle and these multinational conglomerates, that was going to donate half its profits. So they're actually probably pretty smart. So we bootstrapped the business ourselves for the first couple of years, started it in my son's bedroom in L.A., and the thing that we found is even though the investors didn't get it, the consumers got it every single time. So that business grew, and people really, they supported our brand tremendously throughout Southern California. We started to grow through Whole Foods, had tremendous success in the natural channel, and got in touch with this little coffee company in Seattle. Some of you may have heard of it. I don't know. Starbucks. And we basically thought, wow, what a great channel to sell our brand. Coffee is certainly, water is fundamental to coffee, right? 97% of a cup of coffee is water. Water is a huge issue in the countries where Starbucks sources its coffee and tea. Those are all water-stressed countries. And at the same time, as Starbucks grows globally, water could be a great issue as they look at new stores in China, or India, or Brazil. So we pitched them on that, and Starbucks came back and said, actually, we like this so much, we want to buy your company. Well, that was a big surprise. It wasn't what we anticipated. But we thought, actually, there may be an opportunity to achieve on that mission. So we agreed to the sale early 2005, and we figured we could scale the mission because we negotiated, number one, they would expand our philanthropic impact. Instead of 50% of our aspirational profits down the road, Starbucks would donate at least a nickel for every bottle we would sell, no matter what size, no matter where we would sell it, forever. And that might not sound like much, but that was more than double what we could have done on our own. And we will donate between $10 and $12 million over the next 4 years. Pretty big. Wow. Just announced $2+ million. Wow. Just announced $2+ million in investments to bring clean water to communities in Ethiopia and Indonesia. And secondly, they would expand our educational mission because they agreed to make all of our marketing, all of our promotion, all of our communication predicated on this idea of raising awareness about the issue. Because what we realized was that no matter how much money we contribute to the cause, with billions of people in need around the world, it's like a drop in the bucket, to excuse the pun. So it's educating people here at home, getting them inspired to realize ordinary consumers can do something about this issue by buying Ethos Water, by volunteering, making a donation, maybe starting their own social venture to help kids get clean water. And what's exciting to me is there are 40 million people walking through Starbucks every week, probably most of you, actually. And so what we realized is that if we could touch just 1% of that community of people, imagine that, 40,000 people, if we reached them and educated them and inspired 1% of that community, suddenly you're talking about creating a new class of activists who could really change things. So pretty exciting stuff, and the brand will be worth about $50 million this year in sales. We just concluded a deal with Pepsi, which will expand our distribution dramatically. And we'll really have an opportunity to achieve on this idea of helping children get clean water.
I think what's interesting here is you also see the idea of the activist entrepreneur creating the activist customer, which or tapping into, but also then helping to develop an activist customer. Janine, tell us a little bit about biomimicry.
You have every right to be here, by the way.
You do too.
Oh, amazing. I'll tell you how I came, where I came to this place from, and then I'll circle back to it. I'm a natural history writer, and I had written 5 books on plant and animal adaptations, basically how organisms fit hand in glove seamlessly, elegantly in their places, and how they wind up actually enhancing their places. And for the 6th book, and my reason for doing that was to increase people's respect for the natural world. I thought that that would help stay our hand, right? Because it's really hard to watch your mentor go extinct, you know, or something you really admire. But writing these books to a very small audience of people, the church, the choir, I realized that I had to try to reach another audience. I wrote Biomimicry answering the question, who is consciously trying to learn from these organisms, from their adaptations, to improve our own inventions? And I found lots of people. And the book was mainly about people in the research stage. So it was about people trying to improve solar cells by looking at how leaves work, or people trying to improve agriculture by looking at a prairie, or fiber manufacture by looking at how spiders make silk in water at room temp. And I wrote the book, and I went back to write my next natural history book. And the phone started to ring. And it was companies who had committed to a sustainability journey. And it was Monday morning, and they had to innovate. And they said, yeah, we'd like to do bio-inspired innovation. We'd like to have our chemistry more like nature's, we'd like to be as elegant and lightweight as the natural world. But here's the scoop. We don't know anything about biology, and we don't know any biologists. And the only biologists in our companies are those who try to keep us out of jail or, do the body count for fishes and frogs that are going to die because of our progress, right? So they said, can you come over and help us? So a new job was formed called biologist at the design table. So I became a natural historian at the design table, helping engineers and designers make new products based on inspiration from the natural world. But the demand was very great. So we started a thing called Biomimicry Guild, which is a group of biologists who do this. And it's filling a void that we didn't realize we had. But that I see, we're up against it all the time, and that is that.
Was it the most famous example? Is the Swiss guy who was looking at the burrs on his dog and himself, and realized and said, "Eureka, Velcro!" You know, Velcro
right.
was Velcro was a classic biomimicry
classic
product.
Example.
It's sort of the locus classicus of this, and this is now scaling Velcro, scaling that moment.
It's happening everywhere. And so, for instance, and the problem is that there's this gap in knowledge between biological knowledge and engineering knowledge. Every now and then, you have an engineer like a guy at JR West in Japan, who was tasked to make the bullet train quieter. Because the bullet train going into a tunnel would build up a pressure wave. And on the way out, it would create sort of a sonic boom. He happened to be a master birder. And he happened to go to a birding class that night. And he thought to himself, let's see, the train's going through one density of medium to another. What in the natural world, this is the question for biomimics, what in the natural world goes from one density of medium to another? And he thought about a kingfisher, which is a bird that dives for fish, breaking the water without a splash, going from air to water. And they have this amazing spear-like bill. So he tried, imagine scaling a kingfisher's bill onto the bullet train. And he did that, okay, and it quieted the train. But it also increased the speed by 10% and reduced the electricity needed by 15%.
Wow.
Okay, now here's the deal. This guy was a master birder, and we're not going to get that lucky. So what we're trying to do is be more systematic about getting the ideas from biology to flow into human systems design. So we're doing lots of stuff to that effect. We're training biologists to sit at design tables. We're creating with Rocky Mountain Institute a huge web portal in which we will put biological information for designers and engineers free of charge, no matter who you are. You'll get you type in a function like removing salt from water, and you'll get all the masters, the mangroves, the kidneys, seabird nasal glands, what you need to know to be inspired. Because what we found was that's the... Now, bringing it back to where I come from, where my heart comes from, what we... Now Biomimicry Guild, we work with large companies. Interface was the first. We work with General Mills and General Electric and Herman Miller, Seventh Generation, lots of companies in the innovation labs. What we're instituting now is a program called Innovation for Conservation, which will invite these companies to donate a percentage of their proceeds of a bio-inspired product to conserve the habitat of the organism that inspired their invention. And so that's where this natural history writer goes, yes. It's come full circle.
Now, what's interesting, I want to raise one question for the panel quickly and then open it up. Because we've talked about, what's fascinating here is some of you who know my work or heard me the other day know that I think that financial capital and human capital are kind of, and human capital markets are very much related or should be. And one of the interesting things in all of your stories is the question of finding the capital you need, the financial capital you need, finding the master birders wherever they might be, finding, you know, getting the accounting talent, all, you know, the capital markets on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange or in the venture capital field even work relatively well for traditional businesses. Sure, they screw up and you miss some, and you know, then but overall, capital is allocated relatively well across the traditional for-profit sector. But in this large area of social enterprise, both in terms of human capital and financial capital, because there, as you were saying, there are a lot of people, Beth, who want to work in these businesses. What are the things that we can do to improve the way in which financial and human capital is allocated to this spectrum of business? Any thoughts, Cameron?
I think it's about scale. I want to give a couple of examples, which is probably going to connect all three. I have to note that when I was an architect, I worked on your building, but the air conditioning is a little rough.
The elevators are magnificent.
That wasn't me. So I want to talk about innovation, because when we think of innovation and scaling, we always think, in my industry, we think of, and I hate to say it, a white male, right? That's when you think of design architecture. When we're looking at innovation, it's locally based, it's helping them. There's a couple of inventions. One of them is for you. It's the play pump. It was developed in South Africa. And what it is that kids like to play on roundabouts. You know, they go round and round and round. And this is interconnected to a pump system that pulls water up to a cistern. And so while they go round and round, they pull up all the water for the whole village to drink clean water. And then to surround it, because these are ugly canisters, they have HIV/AIDS educational posters. So there's a water story.
We've talked to them, by the way.
Yeah, and they're beginning to scale. So a good connection is to talk to Ethos and trying to scale those. And then five women in a technical college developed an idea of getting two clay pots, slightly smaller, and they filled the gap with sand, and they would put vegetables in it. And if vegetables in this one area would spoil in a day, but when they put vegetables in this double this kind of double width clay pot, the vegetables would last 30 days. Wow. These were five women in a place called Darfur. Mm-hmm. So when you look for innovation, you have to look across the globe. And how does five women...
So they invented the thermos bottle with natural ingredients, with locally sustainable natural ingredients.
Right.
Is that
for 50 cents, right? They've got a fridge. So rather than USAID shipping fridges for $300 and all the cost of, you know, by the way, an airdrop is about the cost of two trucks full of gas for the entire year. So the idea of airdropping all this aid into a community is very cost effective. I mean, we wasted $6 billion on Katrina in the first 2 weeks. If we can come up with innovative solutions that are based locally and help them scale, these women suddenly have a business. Mm-hmm. They've got a business, then they've got some support. So the idea is microeconomic financing that through loan programs. And just to note that when you lend money to women, there is only a 2% corruption level. Men, it's more like 45. But so
there you go.
So there you go. It's to tap into those resources.
You know, I really, if I might reinforce what Cameron is saying, we've seen the evolution of microcredit, these small loans to enable microenterprise developing countries move into the water space and doing tremendous things in places like Bangladesh and India as sort of water credits start to take
hold. Now, if you go in the traditional economy, you will often find local banks that have arrangements with money center banks so that when a small and they like to have small and medium business practices, and because those guys turn out, they give them private, you know, the entrepreneur, the auto dealer, private wealth practice, and, you know, there's a great sort of middle market business there. But, Beth, is there any connection? Is there a link between microfinance and macrofinance? Do you know whether there are financial intermediaries who... We know that between mezzo and macro there are links, but does it go down from... Is there a link between Grameen and East West Bank Corp? Or do you know of any? I don't know. I think they sort of work like E.O. Wilson's slime in a different level.
Acumen is a great example.
They'll find Jacqueline Novogratz in the Acumen Fund. They have
That's an amazing model. Yeah.
I mean, which scales up to $1 million, but they really start with $1,000.
That's real money. Yeah.
And when you start to celebrate that, it starts to attract capital and attract attention to it, which is part of our motivation in celebrating and drawing attention to it, because capital will flow once they start to understand social entrepreneurship isn't about doing things not for profit.
In the big banks, the investment banks are getting into this. So Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan, Goldman, they're all starting to look at this now. But to get back to your earlier point about how do you create the capital markets, well, I think I'm going to guess that most of the people in this room graduated from college. I'm going to guess a fair number of you graduated, went to grad school, right? Maybe many of PhDs as well. And most of you, when you came out, probably had loans. I would say that may be the biggest impediment to the explosion of social entrepreneurship. You have young people who want to do good, but because of the financial constraints that they're under, can't go start a nonprofit, can't go start a socially oriented company to give away half its profits. So how can we change this? Well, we were discussing over dinner, Teach for America. Marvelous, successful program.
How many people here have worked for Teach for America or know somebody who did? That looks like it's about a quarter of the room.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty awesome.
So right now we have AmeriCorps and we have the Peace Corps. Why not start the Social Corps? How about a program to enable graduates from college or grad school to get some kind of loan forgiveness to invest 2 years in social enterprise? Why not?
Great idea.
Sounds like
a
plan.
Another question for Carl for tomorrow.
Exactly. Let's raise the house lights if we can so we can see you when you raise your questions. I can see somebody in the front row. Ma'am. Yeah. And if you have it, aim it. Could you identify yourself? And if it's for someone in particular, please let us know that.
I think microphones
are coming around. Or if you shout, I will repeat it. In the front row, the woman in the front row.
My name's Anna DeVere Smith, and I would like to know if any of you can think of ways that art or artists could be of use to what you're doing, or if those of you who are in the field have had experiences where art or artists help you do what you're doing.
Cameron? You're damn right we could use artists, because for a couple of different reasons. Artists are amazing disruptors. They come into a community and they can really reshape the way communities. When we do community meetings, they kind of look at us really stone-faced in the first kind of couple of weeks. but we've been able to bring artists in that creative process, but also as a complement to some of the creative development. For instance, you don't think about a developing country that aesthetics is the most important thing in somebody's home, but it is. And so you'll be surprised how things like painting and murals and things like that, what we call it in my field is urban acupuncture. You come in and you make the small disruption that creates massive change because suddenly there's a spurt and there's a growth. And if you can look at, there's a film, Favela Rising, where the Brazilian Afro-reggae band actually started drumming amongst the kids. And that started a huge revolution in the favelas where people suddenly said, you know what? I have dignity and I want to prove my housing. And so it went from just getting kids off the street and into kind of a program. And so these programs we partner with all the time because, you know, it's life. I mean, people shouldn't just live. They should have a life. So, I mean, maybe it's a much more a basic approach. But
I have two great stories at both the top and bottom end of that. One is a story about a friend of mine who graduated from the University of Minnesota, decided the weather was too mild, and went to Siberia right after Glasnost and lived for 3 years and founded companies in Siberia. And one of them they founded was a luxury chocolate company on the theory that people needed small luxuries in privation areas. And that sort of goes to the... That's a frivolous response to a more interesting story, which is actually a story of people who were taking mosquito malaria bed nets, and instead of giving them out to villages, they turned them into sort of an Avon calling, you know, a Tupperware thing where people would sell the bed nets. And women would go from village to village. Now they could make a small profit. And one of the things they discovered to this silly little business of art and home decor was if they could make them in different colors, they sold more. And somebody would get a blue one a blue one and a pink one. I don't know what they'd be, but they would do various things with color. But I think the artist is, you know, you get it even at that little mundane level. Little acts of aesthetics, I think, have very powerful economic consequences. In the back, yes, you've got the woman with the microphone. She's got the power. Yes.
Hi, my name's Ian.
Oh, the man. I'm sorry.
My name's Ian. I'm a grad student at the University of Michigan. I'm from Aspen, though. I have a question for Janine, but a short point on microfinance. I worked with microfinance for 9 months in D.C. I spent time in Indonesia and India. I would caution anybody that's associated with investment banks, just be cautious about thinking of it as a silver bullet. There are fundamental issues about the distribution of wealth, banks, foreign exchange, the amount of money coming in that presents massive problems for these communities, just as they present solutions.
So, in other words, micro, you can't...
It's micro for a reason.
They shouldn't be drinking from a fire hose because they can't
drink
from a fire hose.
Yeah, it's micro
right.
for a
you
reason.
You don't scale it up too fast.
Exactly.
Right.
But for Janine, I'm not sure if you know of the Urban Institute, but there are a number of professors there who are big fans of your book, Biomimicry. And if you had to, say, you had a choice between two classes, and you could only take one. One was life cycle analysis. And the other was environmental negotiation and environmental strategy. Which one would you choose and why?
And when do you have to register?
Yeah, they're both on my waiting list.
Oh, I thought you said glass, like glass half empty. I thought I was drinking this. Oh, a class.
Yeah, class, sorry.
Oh, environmental strategy versus life cycle analysis? Oh, wow. Well, they're at opposite ends of the granularity spectrum. The life cycle analysis is extremely important for having us be able to decide which material to use to make a more biomimetic or more sustainable product, right? And all of those material choices have... You know, this basically, for those who don't know what LCA is, life cycle analysis is the story of a product. All the stuff that was used, all the energy and materials that were used to get it to where it's going to be, and all the energy used in its life cycle, and what's going to happen to it at the end of its life cycle. It is the details, and God is in those details, as E.O. Wilson told us. And it's important to know that. The other end of that granularity, it's a very coarse granularity, is the environmental strategy piece, I would probably start at the strategy piece for you. If you had, you know, I would say take both and take them in.
Do they meet at the same time, or can you audit one and take the other for credit?
Take the strategy first, and then get into the details that you'll need to actually get the job done later on. But I would start with the strategy. Before that, I would start by taking an ecology course and find out the strategy of economics that's worked on the planet for 3.8 billion years, and then take environmental strategy.
Well, let me start by just saying I think the stories are very inspirational. We've talked a lot about the demand side and how when you're selling Ethos Water, for example, people are more likely to buy it if they have a social conscience. My question is how it might help you in terms of the human capital that your company has. I know that when Goldman Sachs comes to my law school to recruit, they put out that they are the leader on climate change and a number of other things. And what they're trying to do on that is try to get us to go to them because they are socially conscious. And I know that it works to the extent that, at least among my crowd, that's a big decision maker. And so the best and brightest try to go to the places where they think there's the most social consciousness. And so in addition to your customer base, do you think that it helps with the actual human inputs? And if so, is there any way to try to measure that, or is that a selling point when you're talking about how much to invest in this area, that you don't just look at the bottom line from customers, but also the increased human capital that you might be able to gain?
Why don't we take this from the small and the large point of view?
I can tell you from our point of view, when we started Ethos, we believed there'd be such a thing as an ethical discount. We thought we could get talent that otherwise might go to Clorox or Procter & Gamble, but they would be willing to take less in terms of salary or equity to work for our company because our mission was so noble. We were wrong about that. We were wrong. Because it turns out that those would-be brand managers at Clorox and P&G, who we need, by the way, to compete. We need the best of the best. That's why we began this as a for-profit, because we're competing with Fiji and Evian, you know? So to get the best people, you need to give them the best packages, and we couldn't actually do that. It was high risk, and it wasn't high return, because, again, we were going to give away profits. So we found that it was pretty challenging to get really good talent. Interns, got lots of interns, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of interns, but not a lot of really good people.
But to your point about Goldman Sachs, it matters. The talent coming into our business today, they're looking at the higher purpose. They're looking at what's the organization they're signing up for, what value system are they connecting to, and it's incredibly important to them what culture they're joining and what it stands for.
So there's a peak. Cameron, yeah.
I would just say, actually I have two. I'm going back to Anna's. I just suddenly realized that our Gulf Coast coordinator teaches ballet, and she was at Juilliard. So we don't always have architects, we have a range. But to the other one, you do get a huge pool of interested people. Where we get our the most number of people who try and come to us are people in mid-careers who want to be re-energized.
Sure.
And so what happens is people are willing to take a stipend and go live overseas for a year or go down on the Gulf Coast and work on the Gulf Coast because it's suddenly, you know, after 20 years in a cubicle, you suddenly get, you know, the cobwebs are everywhere. So you really need to re-energize. And if we were a for-profit business, we would be the largest design company in the world. But because we're this kind of decentralized organization, we're able to impact more people through kind of a big distribution network. So I guess it ranges on how your business model is developed.
We have time for one more question here in the
right
front,
here.
and then because the band is. Oh, I'm sorry. We have a question.
Yes.
We have the mic in the back, so let's make a quick question and a quick answer. And I did promise you two, so a quick question, a quick
gentlemen
answer, and we'll wrap up, and the band will drum it out of here.
Gentlemen, yeah. I came in late, so I didn't hear all of your explanations. But I grew up in a black neighborhood till I was about 10 years old. So what I'd like to address to you is in corporate, whether it's international or today, and cultural-wise, you're talking about a lot of great theories. And what I see on this board today is a lot of great, intelligent people. But I'd like to talk about one thing, and the thing I'd like to talk about is whether or not can we take corporate America, the corporate world, bring them underintelligence that you're saying right now, and I've had some drinks, and everybody's like probably laughing. It's true, but
nobody's laughing. But if you can get to the question, because we do have to
the question
hard
is,
stop
the
now.
The question is this: I grew up in a black neighborhood. I'm a white man. I've had to live with black people. You and everything you're preaching right now, can you bring this to a cultural, denomination to the world that what you're saying right now is not a monetary denomination of other people, that you're just dominating the world by your ideas? And anyway.
Well, Cameron, I think that sounds right up your street. Thank you. I'll give you a few statistics. The architectural profession is a male-dominated profession, mainly Anglo-Saxon. Our organization comes from 54 countries. The reality is, I should also note that we're about 70% female, 30% male. 40. The thing is, we need to get the tools globally. We can't, there's definitely a top-down approach to many of these responses. But, the work we've been doing, I am the minority in my organization. We have Sri Lankans, Indians, Africans. And so I think within our organization, there isn't really a divide. We respect people for being human rather than where they're from. But it's important to understand that they are a fantastic resource in doing culturally and environmentally appropriate responses. So, for instance, if I have a project in Tanzania, my partner on the ground is Tanzanian. So, I guess that's my response.
I would think that although we were talking about this earlier offline, that though the people who have been here at the Aspen Idea Festival are, it's been a pretty white crowd. I would think that the sector of the economy that we're representing here, although this is a pretty white crowd, is probably the most ethnically and in other ways diverse sector, not only of developing economies, not only in the developing world, but in the United States and in the developed world as well. One more quick question, and then we've got to wrap. Okay, we do have to. The band is going. The band is going to play.
Let me just mention this about knowledge, though, is that we're working with a lot of scientists, but I think some of the knowledge about how life works is going to come from people who do not have academic degrees, and the trick is to find a way to have their knowledge published in an open source way on the web to guide our innovations and to have them recompensed for that knowledge so that we value it, so that people begin to be able to stay in their local places and know those places and get paid for that knowledge.
I think Janine realizes that I'm currently working on that, and we're doing that with Creative Commons. So.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a two-part question. My name is Nora Hawkes, and I'd like to know if there is an international or a national consortium of social entrepreneurs. Do you gather? Do you have a web page? Do you have a newsletter? And the second part of the question is, are you connected to financial services that specialize in socially responsible investing and counsel their clients in that way?
I can take a shot at this.
Take a shot at it, and I can help you with this. It's a good way to help wrap up. Good.
You're talking about capital markets. Mm-hmm. This is an example of the immaturity of the capital markets around social entrepreneurship. So with respect to the latter, I'm not aware of any financial service firms that specialize in social entrepreneurship at this point. There may be. But, you need accounting and, venture and a range of services. And I'm not aware that there is yet anywhere near a critical mass to support would-be social entrepreneurs. With respect to associations, there are some organizations out there. There's a group called Social Venture Network, which is doing some interesting things. Ashoka, which is a marvelous organization, mm-hmm. has organized a tremendous group of people around the world doing this. But again, Ashoka.
A-S-H-O-K-A.
A-S-H-O-K-A. But again, I think there is a dearth of associations and collected intelligence Investor Circle, kind of, sort of. Omidyar Network is also doing some interesting
Foundation.
Things.
Well, the Schwab Foundation, we can wrap some up. All right. Yeah.
So there are things
but
happening.
I wanted to wrap up with three quick points before thanking these people for an extraordinary evening and you for some great questions. And those three quick points were one about intermediaries, which is partly your question. And you get intermediaries on the financial side and on the knowledge side, and in very, there are things like the Intercity Economic Forum, which was partly started by Michael Porter. There is Bridgespan, the consulting firm for not-for-profit organizations, founded by Tom Tierney, who used to run Bain. And with that, an interesting organization called BridgeStar, which is a job placement people for those people in midlife who are sick and tired of life in the Dilbertvilles and want to get out to... to want to change careers. You know, I mean, as life expectancies have changed, what's happened is that middle age has lengthened. It's not that old, we're still old for 10 years. We're just middle aged for longer, and so you get that second career that happens. So there's a group of organizations in different areas. The Schwab Foundation, Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum, starting that, and Ashoka and some others. So, but there's not one place, but there are a bunch of them. But the issue of intermediaries is, I think, a big deal in this sector as in all others. They are immature, they're young, and as this part of the business, or let's call it the work and value-adding world, it's not necessarily business, as it grows, we're going to see more intermediaries and we're going to need more intermediaries, and it'll be a big deal. Second of all, a number of people mentioned the word mission. And mission, I mean, I work for a not-for-profit, and you know, a not-for-profit that makes a substantial contribution to Harvard Business School, so it's a profitable not-for-profit. But the role of mission in these organizations is extremely important, and it seems to me that mission has two kinds of things. One, for a lot of established companies, mission means sustainability. Let's, you know, do no evil. Do no harm. It's the let's figure out a way to make Alcoa carbon neutral. Let's figure out a way to be to have as light a footprint on the world as Justice Breyer has in his ability to talk. You know, and a sort of delicious delicacy as we walk through the business world and make our products and do our things. And the other mission is a kind of a cause mission. Let's fix a water problem. Let's fix an environmental problem. Which brings me to the third point that I want to make, which is the point of unmet needs. And it is, in fact, the very traditional aspect of these untraditional businesses. 33 years ago, we published the great article by Dan Yankelovich about market segmentation, defining market segmentation. And what market segmentation is about is finding a group of people, that's the segmentation part, and then finding what their unmet need is. And maybe their unmet need is a cold beer on a hot day, but maybe their unmet need is water in a village or a pump, you know, a playground for their kids and a pump. And the unmet needs of in the needing to be green economy in the developing world, in all kinds of other areas, are immense. And finding a way to bring markets around or bring enterprises around those unmet needs is actually the classic act of business when it's doing its job. It's simply doing it in a different area and maybe in a different scale and maybe at a different price point and maybe with some hairier, more challenging economics. But for those of us who are in business, it's what we know how to do. It's just doing it in a slightly different way.
Can I say one last thing very quick? All of you can help with this. This group at Aspen is by no means a representative sample set. You are the cream of the crop. I mean it. So if you believe in what you're hearing and you find any inspiration in it, go mentor a social entrepreneur. Make an angel investment in that next social enterprise that happens by your door. Spread the word. There is so much that you can do to help advance the cause and catalyze this movement.
Good point.
All right. These guys were fabulous. Thank you all. You were great. And so were you.
Great.
Thank you.
Good job, Cameron.
This was good. This was fun.
This was rocking. Thank you, Tom.
Good job, Tom.
Great job.